when abortion was illegal in the United States, women resorted to drastic measures, and deaths from back alley abortions were common. In 1973, when the Supreme Court reached its landmark decision in the case of Roe v. Wade, casualties declined dramatically. In recent years, those opposed to abortion have been working to make it illegal once again. The result is a return to the fear and danger of the back alleys.
We're hearing about knitting needles again. We're hearing about bleach douches again. And they may not be reporting it to their physician or to the judge that they end up talking to or to the clinic worker at the hospital, but there are girls out there doing that.
I hope that my daughter never has to worry about something like this. That the battle was won and fought by her mom to preserve a right for her to make those own decisions for herself and nobody tell her what she has to do.
If Roe v. Wade is undone, women will still go and look for abortions, whether they're legal or not. So what we're going to see is the same number of abortions, but with an increase in the fatalities for women of childbearing age.
The fragile promise of choice. Abortion in the United States today. The majority of Americans support choice. They believe that a woman has a right to make her own decision. Through the efforts of a vocal anti-choice minority, access to abortion in the United States is being eroded. Spurred by religious conviction, opponents of abortion carry out their mission on two fronts. One is through legislation, where state by state, laws are being passed that create barriers for women seeking abortions. The other is through clinic protests, where some of the most vehement attacks are being carried out.
Please don't let them hurt you! He killed a woman!
You're going to stand before Almighty God for murder, young lady. Murder of a baby.
Right now, you're the mother of a live baby. But when you leave here, you'll be the mother of a dead baby.
I tell you that every one of you will be responsible before a righteous God at the throne of judgment.
When I went for the abortion, the thing that frightened me was this one woman. And she was saying, you know, the blood's still on your fingers, turn back now. And they were just really cruel. They were just, I don't know, they were saying this is murder and how can you do a thing like this? But I don't know, I don't think they realized what I was going through. And I mean, they were pushing me and when I was trying to get the doors and everything, it was awful. It was really awful.
When I left the clinic and walked outside, I got real sick. And there were protesters out on the sidewalk and said, you know, one guy was carrying a sign that says, "Mommy, please don't kill me." And I still remember that. It was a long time ago, but I'll still remember that sign. I'll probably never forget.
The tactics of those protesting abortion have been escalating. From sidewalk picketing to a reign of terror.
Violence at an abortion clinic in Florida.
He just went up, chased the doctor down, and just shot him point blank.
Dr. David Gunn was shot and killed outside a Pensacola clinic on his way to work.
Tiller, one of the few doctors to perform late-term abortions, was shot in both arms last night as he got into his car outside of his Wichita abortion clinic.
It took just 2 minutes for Paul Hill to fire off more than 6 rounds and kill 2 people.
A Canadian gynecologist who performs abortions was shot in his home this morning. Police say Garson Romales was sitting at his breakfast table when he was shot by an assailant armed with an assault rifle.
A man burst into a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic and opened fire with a rifle. Minutes later, an identical attack occurred at a second clinic a mile and a half away.
He was right behind me. He had a shotgun. I jumped over the wall. He was shooting everybody.
The murders, which stunned most of the country,
were condoned as justifiable homicide by a handful of religious extremists, like this priest.
God wants us to do what is right, and killing abortion doctors may be, for some people, what is right.
The recent wave of terrorism has left abortion providers across the nation facing the difficult decision of whether or not to continue. This doctor lives with his wife and their child in a small New England village. Their life, however, has been far from quiet. Like so many other providers throughout the country, this physician has been the target of picketers for years.
We went away over Christmas and came back to find a letter in my mailbox that said, you better check your baby-killing facility, and then any questions, the big question mark. And underneath it, it showed a picture of a .357 Magnum pointing directly out of the page, being held by hand.
I came to work with my husband every day, and when the picketers started coming, they would be outside, lined up on the street, and that feeling of dread as we drove towards work would always be there. So you're working under enormous pressure of people outside harassing women you're trying to help. Women that are there because they need or want to be there. That feeling of dread just carried over when we'd come home. Will there be a phone call? Will there be another piece of hate mail? What's next?
Well, approximately 9 months before I closed my practice, there was a bullet fired into the waiting room of my office. As time progressed from that shooting, and we found that the law enforcement agencies, and there were many involved, really were not putting much effort into trying to solve this case. It became apparent to me that we were in real danger.
They know where we live. We could move. They could find us again. What kind of harm is out there for my child?
Throughout the country, abortion clinics face threats and harassment on a regular basis. Since 1977, there have been more than 12,000 incidents of violence and disruption. This clinic director in Vermont has had to learn to cope.
What you take on when you provide abortion services is all of the anti-choice protesting, picketing. We have had bomb threats throughout our history. Then we had a long period of time where there would be a car parked in the driveway and men would have locked their necks to the chassis of the car from underneath, and the police and the rescue would have to come to remove the protesters. Another time we came and three of them were locked together at the front door of the health center with a huge lock system that was encased in cement, and then they had destroyed the lock so that the police would not be able to get them apart. And this was one of the most creative responses, I think, on the Burlington Police Department's part. They came and picked the three individuals who were locked together up, walked them across the street, left them on the front lawn of the Catholic diocese, who had been allowing them to park there and supporting their activity. And we found them at 8 o'clock in the morning. They couldn't get themselves apart until midnight that night.
We're now being given notice. You are trespassing on this property, and if you fail to leave, you will be arrested for unlawful trespass, Title 13.
We weathered the period of blockades and invasions. And I think what's really been unfortunate in the media is that everything is so polarized, and they represent women in this
society, women in this country, as two groups of women, women who have abortions and women who have babies. And when you provide all those services, you recognize that we're the same women at different times in our life.
More than 100 fires of suspicious origin have struck women's health centers, sometimes the same location more than once. The staff of one California clinic has weathered a series of arsons.
The first fire that I recall was a fire that started, we were told it was started by a cigarette. And we were told that the cigarette traveled about 20 feet down the cement walkway and around a cement guardrail and up a 10-inch cement lip and down underneath the house. And then it somehow gathered debris and started a fire. And that was our first fire, and we, you know, were very suspicious, and I think we were more surprised that the local powers that be weren't suspicious.
Over the next 5 years, this clinic suffered three more arsons. After one of these, the facility had to close for 8 months, and women were forced to travel an additional 100 miles to the nearest provider.
It's very difficult to have this happen. Four times, all of them unsolved.
There's a bomb. Stop killing little babies.
The day before we arrived to film at this Minnesota clinic, they received a series of threatening phone calls.
There's a bomb. Stop killing little babies.
He called back about 30 different times, talked to one of the nurses, told her that he had a high-powered rifle with a scope and that he was going to kill her. When she went out to get her car, the police came and we said, put a trace on it. And they still wouldn't do anything.
Many clinics report that law enforcement agencies do not respond sufficiently to threats. Clinic staff like this physician who performs abortions must always be on guard.
There's probably not a day that goes by that I don't think of my own safety or the safety of my family when it comes to abortion and risks that are involved, the political fallout that you have seen taking place every day. My children are 10 and 12 years of age, and my 10-year-old daughter, when she sees my bulletproof vest, will say, well, Daddy, I hope no one kills you or wants to kill you. And that's what makes it real for me.
The Lord burns your hands off. You murderer, you filthy murderer.
In this embattled environment, fewer and fewer doctors are willing to provide abortion services. An increasing number of communities have no local providers. Many clinics, especially those in rural areas, are forced to fly doctors in from out of state. This physician travels hundreds of miles every week.
I never intended to be a full-time abortion doctor. I provided abortion services because they were doctors were needed. I was told that before Dr. Tiller got shot in the hand up in Wichita, Kansas, that I was an alternative target. Shortly after that, we were approached by the FBI and by the U.S. Marshals Service, and it was their decision to provide me with protection. If everybody dropped out of doing this because they were being intimidated, then there'd be no abortion providers. And perhaps I'd feel different if I was in my 40s, a young doctor, but I'm 64 years old. I'm going to be retiring soon, and I'm not going to quit what I'm doing.
This clinic director works 100 miles from Pensacola, Florida, where two doctors and an escort were killed.
We've really experienced some horror at the clinics in the nearby area. We've experienced some pretty scary things here with people who are opposed to women having safe and legal choice.
Individuals who continue to work in this climate are often motivated by personal memories of the back alley days.
This all began for me in the mid-60s, and I had a good friend, and she was pregnant and couldn't take care of any more children. And kept asking the doctor to help her, and he knew exactly what she meant. and he couldn't. Then I got a phone call, and she'd been taken to the hospital, hemorrhaging, and she bled to death. And I went back to where she worked and told her boss, and she said, come back here. And we went into the restroom, and there was blood everywhere. And we started cleaning it up because we didn't know if the police would be involved. We just didn't know what was going on. And I found a screwdriver behind the commode that had blood all over it. She did it to herself.
Before abortion was legal, many women died from self-induced abortions. Now, once again, hospital emergency rooms report treating women who resort to unsafe methods. Chris was a sociology major in her senior year at a state university when she discovered she was pregnant. Like many young women her age, she was not ready to have a child. She obtained an abortion at a clinic during a wave of protests. Her friends describe what they remember.
I went down with her, and we waited in the waiting room for I don't know how long. And there's people outside marching around, and then we're inside of there, and there's all sorts of, like, kind of weird tension inside the waiting room. And she had a really bad experience there.
I think she didn't understand why she felt so ashamed of herself.
Exactly. Totally. You know?
And I think it took her years to figure out that it had something to do with that experience, but I don't think she ever knew exactly what.
Chris became pregnant again after her birth control failed. She did not want to go back to a clinic because her first experience had been so disturbing.
Please consider the life that you're carrying. Don't snuff it out. You'll never forget this. This day will go down in the rest of your life. You'll never get over it.
Chris had been studying natural medicine and decided to use herbs as an abortifacient. Soon afterwards, she began to cramp.
When the cramping got really bad, she thought she was aborting. And so she didn't go to a doctor, she didn't go to see anyone. The 12th of August, I got a call at 4 o'clock in the morning, and she had gone into convulsions in the bathtub. She was taken to the hospital, and she'd had cardiac arrest, and then they'd found out that she'd had an ectopic pregnancy, and that the cramping that she was feeling was that she had been hemorrhaging probably for 2 weeks, because they said that there was dried blood in and around her fallopian tubes and in her uterus, and that's what killed her. I think that she really wanted to go to somebody. I mean, we talked about it. She didn't want to be in charge and take all this responsibility. I think if there had been somebody for her to go to, that she would still be alive.
To abortion rights advocates who fought to save women's lives by changing the laws, history seems to be repeating itself.
I can remember the last time we had a march and walking down the street and thinking, I thought that we wouldn't have to do this anymore. You know. And I think what happened is that when the Supreme Court decision was won, we all went, that's it, we won. And we relaxed. But at the same time, you had these groups that were organizing to repeal it. And what they did was chip away a little bit at a time over the years. Because then Medicaid funding wasn't allowed for poor women. And then there was spousal consent that came up. And then you couldn't provide services to unmarried minors without parental notification or parental consent. So there's been a lot of chipping away at the decision, which I think is unfortunate. But it means that you can never relax.
As new restrictions are being enacted throughout the country, a generation that does not remember the history is becoming aware of the current threat to reproductive rights.
I vividly remember the moment that I became an abortion activist, and that was the evening of July 3rd, 1989, when I was watching the news and heard of the Webster decision.
This medical student recalls exactly what inspired her commitment.
States could now restrict abortion rights on a case-by-case basis. And what happened directly after that was some 500 anti-choice measures and bills were introduced. So it had a tremendous impact. It was a gateway to anti-choice legislation.
Bills inspired or drafted by anti-abortion politicians are now pending or have passed in almost every state. In Kentucky, as in 30 other states, abortion funding is only available in cases of rape, incest, or life endangerment.
We went for the ultrasound, and then she lifted down the cover and she said, you need to go over to Dr. White's office. And I said, why, is there something wrong? She said, you just need to go over there.
This young woman, a Medicaid recipient, was denied assistance to terminate a severely abnormal pregnancy.
Dr. White was telling me how some babies were born without a kidney, some babies were born without a heart or arm or, you know, an organ. And then she said, well, your baby was without a brain tissue. So that was the hardest thing I've ever heard in my life.
The doctor confirmed that this fetus would not survive after birth.
It was obvious that the baby was anencephalic, which an anencephalic baby is a baby that when the neural tube or the spinal cord brain segment begins to develop, there is no development at the top of the spinal cord. So you have up to the brain stem, which is the base of the brain back here that controls breathing, the heart rate, but nothing above it. So above, from the ears and the eyebrows up, there is nothing. There is no brain.
The pregnant woman's mother helped her daughter make a difficult decision.
Well, Angela just cried and cried and cried because we wanted this baby so much. And I asked the doctor, I said, what do we do now, you know? And she said she can carry the baby for 9 months and take a risk on Angela's life, and knowing that the baby had no chance, or we could go and take the baby now and just do it this way and because of Angela's life.
If I continued the pregnancy, the child would not, you know, survive, not even a minute. So she said that that the dangers were that the placenta, there would be a chance where I could hemorrhage to death if I just went ahead and did that. And so I say no. I didn't see what, you know, why would I want to go through a whole 9 months giving birth to a baby that wasn't going to be alive?
To spare Angela the medical risk of carrying to term and the trauma of giving birth to a baby with no chance of survival, the family decided to end the pregnancy. They soon discovered that the several $1,000 cost of the operation would not be covered by Medicaid.
It was not an option for them to pay for this out of pocket. They would have had to stay within the medical card system, would have gone through the pregnancy, would have gone through the delivery, and then would have gone through the loss.
And so Dr. White was telling me about this organization where they're trying to pass a law that people on Medicaid could didn't have, you know, shouldn't have to do it because, you know, they know we didn't have the money and the baby wouldn't survive and my life was in danger.
The ACLU took up this case to bring attention to the injustice of a law that does not take dangerous, high-risk pregnancies into account.
I think there's a very passionate group in this state who are against abortion for any reason at all, ever, period, never. There's nothing in this world that's that black and white. And
you're dealing with people who are not involved with a medical situation trying to make blanket decisions. If you've ever looked into a woman's eyes when you've just told her that her baby is doomed, it's, if they could see that, they would know why this has to be kept safe and legal, and why we don't need more barriers for these women.
Before we went through with this, I was against abortion. But when a situation comes up as much as this, there's got to be somebody to help these people, or mothers that's gone through this. And I don't care what anybody says, you know, how could you do this? And they're not in my shoes. They went in Angela's shoes.
The Fragile Promise of Choice was produced by Beth Seltzer and directed by Dorothy Fadiman. Adaptation for radio, Frieda Worden, Women's International News Gathering Service. Camera, Daniel Myers and Blake McHugh. Associate producer, Danielle Renfrew. Assistant to the director, Kristen Atwell. Editor, Nyla Bogue. Music, Etika Luckett. Narrator, Dorothy Fadiman. Executive producer, Danny McGuire. Produced in association with KTEH-TV, San Jose.